morning. The meeting of the House State Affairs Committee, the public hearing, will begin. We have present here in Anchorage Representative Jenkins, and in Juneau, Committee Member Representative Miller. I'm expecting Representative Boucher and Representative Collins and Representative Navarre. The last time we met on this piece of legislation was in April 18, and we had a hearing at that time across the state. At this time, I understand we have people listening in at several sites, and we're very happy that you're joining us. First of all, I'd like to have George Mundell of the Office of Alcoholism and Drug Abuse give sort of an overview of the legislation, or whatever you'd like to say at this point. Would you come up to me? And for the benefit of those out listening who are not here, and those of you who are here, the plan is after Mr. Mundell, we will have Victor Coleman, who is from the Prevention Research Center in Berkeley, California, who will discuss the Model Dram Shop Act. And we have, I know of two people who are present who wish to speak, and we'll see how far we get by 11:30. I am warned that not to go over as we did last week and overtime during the little break at 11:30, and we can go a few minutes, but, and then we'll begin again at 11:30. Would you go ahead, please, Mr. Mundell?
Chair, this is Mike and Joe. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine.
Okay, great. Good morning. Just a couple of quick things I wanted to advise you. First of all, you're coming just a little bit faint, so maybe speak a little bit closer to the mic. But just to advise you, my schedule, I'm going to be here probably for about an hour, hour and a half, and then I'm going to have to leave, and I'll be in and out. I think Bob Speed from my office is either in your at your side right now, or at least will be shortly, so he'll be observing on my behalf. But then, would you say again when you're going to recommence in the afternoon so I can be here?
1:30, Mike. Is that better? Am I coming in clearer now?
Yes, very well. Thank you very much.
Okay, I also wanted to mention that Representative Coxon is here with us at the table. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam.
State your name and so forth so the record will be clear.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is George Mundell, and I'm with the Office of Alcoholism and Drug Abuse within the Department of Health and Social Services. And briefly, was interested in reviewing the present situation. I believe at the hearing last April, the committee did receive the department's position paper, which is favorable on House Bill 345. Favor of it. Certainly you received the governor's transmittal letter, which pretty much explains the tack that was taken in the development of House Bill 345. It is a horribly complex issue, but I believe it is also a very simple change. The change came about as a recommendation to the governor by the work of the governor's task force on drunk driving. I might add that that group met last December and heard testimony from several expert witnesses and interested persons over a period of 2 days. The makeup of the task force, there were interested citizens in the form of the Review Board on Alcoholism. There were members on the task force from the licensed beverage industry, from enforcement, prosecution. There was a judge on the task force, certainly defense counsel, and the task force was chaired by the House Majority Leader, Representative Clausen. There's been considerable work done on the problem of drunk driving in Alaska. It is a very serious problem in terms of death, personal injury, and property damage. And I believe, too, the Alaska state legislature's credit, you have passed several laws in the last few years to address this problem. The task force certainly was aware of some of the recent changes in the drinking driving statute during the course of their deliberation when they established that this particular idea to revise the dram shop law was their number one priority. Addressing the dram shop issue was not unique to the governor's task force on drunk driving. It certainly was indicated as a strategy to look at in the President's Commission on Drunk Driving. It also was an idea that was advanced in Mayor Noble's here in Anchorage, the Mayor's Task Force on Drunk Driving, and has been a strategy that's been looked upon by quite a few groups, such as the Mothers Against Drunk Driving and Alcohol Abuse Prevention Professionals. The standard for negligence prior to 1980, apparently, was what they call ordinary negligence. I'm not an attorney, so excuse me if I don't hit all of these terms exactly as they should be. However, in the rewrite of Title IV in 1980, that standard was changed for server licensed servers to one of criminal negligence. So a few minutes ago, I was saying that it is a very complex issue, but it also is a very simple change. In that what the task force was interested in was just to restore to the pre-1980 status that standard of negligence that would apply to licensed servers. And so it used to be ordinary negligence in common law. In 80, the legislature changed it to a criminal standard, and now the task force has recommended through House Bill, through the governor's introduction of House Bill 345, that the standard be returned to ordinary negligence. Some have said that it's singling out an industry and that it's very punitive to a licensed legal industry, that being the beverage industry. It is true it is a legal industry, but it is also equally true that they deal in a very dangerous substance. Alcohol, we have lots of data that indicates that it really has an adverse impact on the health and safety status of many Alaskans. Idea or that fact, if you will, should not get lost in discussion of this issue. It is a special product. It's not like toys or strawberries or other types of product. It's a very dangerous substance that we're dealing with here. Also, in the governor's transmittal letter, he did recognize the problem that licensees are having in obtaining liability insurance, and is interested in a workable solution on that problem. We've been told that the liability insurance problem, if you will, would have been a problem had there never been a task force on drunk driving, or had there never been an introduction of House Bill 345. There was a conference yesterday on this liability insurance problem, which I might add impacts not only beverage dispensary license holders and package store license holders, but other risk groups as well, such as physicians, attorneys, licensed daycare centers, aircraft, air taxi operators, architects. There's a wide group that are experiencing these insurance difficulties, liability insurance difficulties, and what's some of the speakers were saying yesterday that this is not a new crisis, that it's a recurring crisis that happens about every 10 years, and that is the result of a lot of factors having to do with risk and insurance company profits from investments and premium rates that perhaps were too low a few years ago, and now all of a sudden they are very expensive. So I recall at the prior hearing, there was considerable testimony that the committee heard regarding this House Bill 345 and the impact it was having on insurance. And at least from our perspective, the insurance problem would exist with or without a 345, House Bill 345. I think with the question of insurance as it relates to the dram shop liability, I'll be very interested in hearing from Mr. Coleman and the provisions that are contained in this model act on dram shop and liquor licensee liability, because there are some things there maybe that can assist in that area, and that's in looking at how settlements are made. And there's just some of the examples that I have heard of are, the idea of having a structured settlement, annuity payments rather than a big cash payment would tend to drive down the price of settlements on dram shop liability suits, which in fact would assist on the insurance issue. Certainly, other areas they were mentioning yesterday were the elimination of the reduction of pre-judgment interest, having juries being able to instruct juries regarding the income tax windfall benefit that the recipients of settlements enjoy, and certainly a look at the awarding of punitive damages. Perhaps that could be reserved only for the most serious offenses and not be available in all. But again, at least in my mind, I do see this as two separate issues. One is the dram shop and the restoring of the criminal removing the criminal and making the ordinary standard of negligence, which would be restoring it to the pre-1980 statute. And I see that pretty much as the issue at 345. And again, the point that the insurance is a separate issue, but is an area that I'm sure you'll be looking at in the coming year as well. I, with that, do not have any more comments, but certainly would be pleased to try and answer any questions.
Does anyone on the committee have a question? Just to be the devil's advocate, do you favor the prohibition then? When you said that, they're dealing with a very dangerous substance, is prohibition then really the only answer?
Oh, I don't think in today's society that the prohibition is the only answer. I think that when the prohibition federally was repealed, Congress gave the right to legislate around the sale of beverage alcohol to the individual states. I think in Alaska we do have areas of prohibition that work very nicely. This is, you're probably aware of, through the local option election feature in our alcohol beverage control statute. I think that the prohibition is the answer in some of these remote villages where they do not have the health resources and the public resources to pick up the carnage, the problems that occur when there is too much drinking, drunkenness and violence, and health issues. So it is a legitimate response in an area like that. I cannot see that prohibition would be a proper response in any urban area.
Thank you. Did you have any
thing
that you wanted to add? You're welcome to ask questions. Representative Collins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize for being late. I missed part of your testimony, and I'm wondering if you address the impact that a change in the law would have on homeowners. My understanding is that in some of the states where the criminal negligence has been removed from the statute, that it's had. It's been my understanding that in some of the other states, or probably all of the other states where the criminal negligence has been removed from the statute, that it's had a negative impact on the general population in the sense that it's made them also more liable for anyone who drinks in their home. And it's had the impact of increasing the homeowner's policies, and in some instances, people not being able to afford homeowner policies because the liability becomes so great The one example that I heard was that, for example, the company party was no longer, Christmas party was no longer something that people did anymore in New Jersey, for example, because the risk was simply too high, and that people in New Jersey, the person that I specifically was speaking to, many people could not afford their homeowner policies. If you had a party at your home, what you had to do was take everybody's keys and hold them and send people home in cabs, and basically people were just not socializing, I guess. And I'm just curious in terms of what your response is, how to that concern or that problem that's been voiced.
Well, I'm certainly opposed to any insurance increases on my homeowner's policy. And my understanding that this bill would not impact that homeowner's insurance policies at all. This bill will just change from the criminal to an ordinary negligence standard for licensed servers. And so as such, this bill is silent on that entire issue of social host liability. Under this bill, it would just change the standard to the pre-1980 what the experience was then. And I know in pre-1980, I did not have excessive homeowner insurance rates because of social host responsibility. So this bill doesn't have anything to do with the social host question.
Thank you. But my understanding is, from speaking particularly with this individual from New Jersey who's an attorney, that even though their original bill did not address the social host, the courts interpreted it to include the social host when someone brought an action against the homeowner who had a party and had served some drinks, and the court in their decision changed the law to include the social host.
Again, this bill only pertains to licensed servers and doesn't have anything to do with anybody providing a drink in a home. That would be a separate issue. Perhaps Representative Boxer could elaborate on that.
Well, I was going to ask Representative Clarkson, isn't it true that even now, under common law, that without this law, you still could be sued? Is that correct?
I don't want to get into a long legal discussion. I think the short answer to Representative Collins' question is that the passage of this legislation would not affect social host liability one way or the other. It was an opinion by the Supreme Court in New Jersey that under the common law, the unwritten law, that in fact there was liability if you negligently served someone in your home and allowed them to go home and didn't take reasonable precautions. That same court case could happen right today in Alaska. Nothing that we're considering here would change that whatsoever. I was going to say in my testimony in a moment here, I'll add that as chair of the Drunk Driving Task Force, I supported a social host liability in the statute, but that's not part of this bill.
Thank you, Representative Clarkson. I want the record to show that both Representative Collins and Representative Boucher are present. Are there any further questions of Mr. Mundell, Representative Jenkins?
This isn't really a question, but Representative Collins, for everyone's knowledge, back just talking to Representative Clarkson about this, this morning's news reported the governor of New Jersey, Governor Kane, has put a freeze upon all liability policies in the state of New Jersey. So this is not an isolated case, and I do understand that I think the possible ramifications of the law, but this is a limited liability, and that is another separate issue, as Representative Fox said, negligence-wise within the home. But New Jersey is certainly having the same problems, and maybe on a larger scale than we are. I don't know if they have the answer either.
Thank you, Representative Jenkins. I also neglected to mention in the opening that Catherine Bigler from the Mothers Against Drunk Driving will be here this afternoon, as I understand. I know she indicated that she wanted to be present, so for the information of those out there who may want to be aware of what the agenda covers. If that's all, thank you very much. And at this time, Victor Coleman.
Coleman of Prevention Research Center out of Berkeley, California. Prevention Research Center is one of nine national alcohol research centers in the United States funded through federal funds. We deal specifically with prevention of alcohol problems, not a treatment association, but prevention. And I've been working on the dram shop issue for a couple of years now. And Jim Mosier originally received a grant from the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism to study dram shop liability and to come up with a comprehensive model dram shop act, which we did. I have the act here and I have my written testimony as well, which I'll pass out. Within that dram shop grant, I went around to three different states, Michigan, Massachusetts, and California, interviewed attorneys on their dram shop cases. The one finding there, most significant, was that the business practices of these establishments, we can call them licensees, restaurants, bars, anybody holds a license to sell alcohol. The people involved in these cases, nobody was looking at the business practices of the establishments, meaning the hiring practices, the serving practices, the supervising practices going on in that establishment. And this will be significant when I talk about the Section 10 of our provision. After interviewing the attorneys, we have also looked at all the appellate court cases in the United States, which number over 1,000. So if you have general questions on dram shop law comparing to other states, I'm a good source for that as well. We also compiled information on the new state-of-the-art server training program. Server training is something that is springing up around the country. Sometimes it's industry-based. The alcohol beverage industry has its own programs. There's private programs. And even some states and counties are starting to have their own programs. Perhaps it's prerequisite to licensing or insurance. Those are some good issues we could talk about a bit. In any case, the culmination of the research was the Model Dram Shop Act. We wrote a draft of it in November and December of 1984, sent it out to over 100 interested parties, and we got comments back from some of those people, incorporated those comments, and came out with a final draft in January of 1985. Last year was a little bit late for the law to be introduced in very significant ways in state legislatures, but we did get it introduced in Hawaii, parts of it in California and Oregon, and there's a number of states this year that are taking an active interest in the model law, including Florida, Ohio, Michigan, and Vermont. So it's really starting to get disseminated now, and people are becoming interested in it. Let me say one thing about dram shop and the model law. A lot of people, when they hear dram shop liability, they think that you're shifting the burden of responsibility from the drinker to the server, and that is never the case. You're simply sharing the responsibility, sharing the burden of the foreseeable events that occur when there's improper serving. So dram shop simply says that not only are the servers, not only are the drinkers liable, but the servers who improperly serve are liable as well. The most significant and perhaps innovative part of the Model Dram Shop Act is Section 10, which we call Responsible Business Practices Defense. This is a section that gives licensees a defense from liability if they can show they have done responsible business practices in those areas I described earlier, hiring and training and supervising, and there's a non-exclusive list of factors to be considered by juries and courts when they look at whether or not a licensee has done all they could. Because what we saw from our research was that a lot of cases could be termed nuisance cases, meaning there's a lot of areas where it's certainly gray whether or not the person was served, obviously intoxicated, or whether, most significantly, that. And the minor question is not as difficult. If a person is a minor, generally liability can result. But the standard right now in most states is obvious or apparent or visible intoxication or simply intoxication alone. And that is an ambiguous standard. So we decided to open up the evidentiary proof in a dram shop case, say that is not the only significant part of dram shop to look at. Let's look at what the servers did in that case. Did they hire people properly? Did they train them at all? Did they implement the training at the time of service? And did they supervise them as well? A place that is understaffed and complains, well, we're serving too many people, that's a sign of inadequate supervision or inadequate staffing and personnel, and that can be held against them. On the other hand, there's cases where licensees did all they could, yet somebody slips through the cracks and does get served. A lot of times these people are bar hopping, going from one place to another, and it's hard to know whether or not, in that specific case, they were obviously intoxicated. So we say, let's give licensees a defense from liability and give them incentive to beef up their practices by saying, you have a defense if you can show you did all you could if you had responsible business practices. This also encompasses the recent efforts by the alcohol industry to incorporate server training or server intervention programs. As I stated earlier, it's something that's becoming more widespread in a number of different states. So because server training is coming to the forefront, more people will have an opportunity to have actual training itself. The idea is to give licensees incentive for those who aren't as responsible as they should be, give them some incentive to have better practices. And for those who already have good practices, this section can provide them a defense from liability. Now, the idea behind the law, I come from a nonprofit institution and we work in the public health. So this law is not based on the plaintiff side or defense side. It's simply a bill in the interest of public health. We're looking to prevent alcohol-related injuries in the best way we can, in the most equitable way we can through this Model Act. So depending on what state we go into, sometimes we get support from the industry and sometimes we get support from the other side, from plaintiff's attorneys and other people. But it is a bill based in public health. There's a couple other significant parts to Dram Shop liability. I'll address a couple of them. One is the social host liability question. As far as I know, the criminal negligence standard that is now existing in Alaska is the only type of its kind in the state. And when you do have social host liability created, like in New Jersey, it's exactly how was stated earlier, that it's written, or it's the unwritten law, the common law, the court-made or judge-made law that acts as precedent. That is what creates a social host liability in some cases. Social host is a tough question. The Model Act remains neutral on that question because we have written this Model Act to be read in conjunction with the ABC statutes of the state, the alcohol beverage control statutes. The standards we set out in Section 10 to say whether or not a licensee has responsible business practices is something that's geared toward people who have licenses. So the social host question has to be looked at in a different way, and I would not recommend that it would be just subsumed within the statute if that was the case. It should be thought of very carefully, and there should be different standards of care for the social host than there is for the commercial host. And in fact, in New Jersey, the case that was written on social host, Kelly v. Grinnell, the court made it very clear that it was trying to establish a narrow standard of care for that host. In that case, it was a one-on-one situation where the person served over 13 drinks to the other person in the space of an hour and a half. And the court said, we can't shut our eyes to this. It's too blatant, too egregious. In this situation, when you have one-on-one situation, doesn't it make sense that the person would foresee that this person was intoxicated and could get into an accident? He put him in his car and said, goodbye, see you later. So in that case, the judge tried to write a very narrow decision and say, social host liability can exist only in these narrow circumstances. But anytime you say social host liability, everybody gets all scared and thinks that sky's the limit on liability and homeowners policies could go up and such. This court tried to create a very narrow duty, yet the press and the media covers it just like it's any other social host decision. I think you wrote a good decision, but it must be looked at carefully, and any statute that discusses social host must look at the standards of care in a different way than a commercial host. A couple of possibilities, Oregon has a standard that says it must be reckless service of alcohol, not negligent service, but a higher standard, a reckless standard of care. And in that case, you can have the social host held liable. That's one possibility in terms of social host and trying to be fair to the people who have parties at home. Another way, in Pennsylvania, and through their common law, says there's social host liability for service to minors only, so that no service to adults intoxicated can lead to liability. These are a couple of kind of compromise decisions that other states have reached, and perhaps you'd like to consider them here. Also, wrapped in that social host question is when you do put forth the Dram Shop statute, I would recommend that it would be the exclusive remedy for people recovering, because when you have a wide open statute that says it's not the exclusive remedy, then you always leave common law open, and common law is wide open, and anything can happen in common law, including the social host question. So as written in the model law, I believe section 15, we say that make the Dram Shop statute the exclusive remedy. Therefore, everybody will have barriers, and they know the upper and lower limits of what can be done within a law. So I think it's a good idea to make a Dram Shop law the exclusive remedy. In terms of who can sue, there's always been a question in the Dram Shop arena about whether or not the intoxicated person can sue or not. We take a position that says you can either have an intoxicated minor sue. If you're going to have any people sue, a lot of courts say that the person who's doing the drinking and then inflicts injuries upon themselves are more at fault than the people who serve them, therefore they shouldn't have a cause of action. We say perhaps that's too harsh, maybe you want to cut it off in minors and have minors who are not as capable of understanding the effects of alcohol, have the minors be able to recover for their own injuries, but not adults. That's one delineation you may want to make there. In terms of the complicity question, complicity being whether or not the participants in the drinking event can recover, courts across the country and statutes go both ways on that. Some say the people who participate are just as much as fault as the drinker themselves, therefore they should not have a cause of action. Other courts say, no, they're in the class of persons designed to be protected from drunk driving and other alcohol-related injuries, therefore let's give them a cause of action. We do not recognize the complicity defense, meaning we say that people who participate in the drinking event should have a cause of action. For those people who think that's giving these people who perhaps are somewhat at fault in being involved in the drinking event, if you have comparative negligence, and I don't believe you do in this state, have comparative negligence, you do or not? Yes. Somewhat. Well, if you have comparative negligence, that helps to alleviate the kind of all or none rule of complicity. You can just simply apportion the fault for the person who is simply quiet and sitting in the back seat as opposed to kind of furnishing beers to the person perhaps in the front seat. The juries and the triers of fact can apportion the fault accordingly, so you don't have a real all or none rule there. So it's recommended that a complicity defense not be recognized in a dram shop suit. As I mentioned before, server training is a big issue these days, and there's a couple ways that people and legislatures and other jurisdictions are dealing with the server training question. There is a model server training bill listed as Appendix B in this Model Act, and this part of this bill was enacted in Oregon. Oregon is the first state to pass a server training bill. They're going to make it mandatory by 1987 to have server training in their state. And Massachusetts is also considering incorporating server training into their assigned risk insurance pool. Massachusetts, as a lot of states, have a lot of trouble with the insurance liability question. It's getting very difficult to have insurance. And that also goes back to not having dram shop as your exclusive remedy. Massachusetts has common law, so it's wide open, and anything can happen. There could be social host liability, there could be employer liability. And so insurers have a hard time setting what the risks are, and then that leads to higher premium rates. A way around that, Massachusetts says, we're going to take over the insurance question. We're going to do insurance pooling ourselves and have an assigned risk program. We'll set the rates. And as a prerequisite to getting insurance in Massachusetts, they're going to have server training as a prerequisite, as one of the factors to be involved. So there's a couple different ways you can look at server training. You can make it a prerequisite for licensing. If you take over the insurance issue, you can have it a prerequisite to getting insurance. And the insurance issue is not always so clear as some licensees might state. Sure, liability premiums are increasing, but they are increasing for a lot of people in the business, and the alcohol servers are in the business of serving alcohol and making a profit off that, and they're simply obtaining insurance like any other business would do. They're making a profit, they're insuring against the risks. It's no different than any other type of business involved. And one way to have server training get involved into the insurance question is to have those licensees who do server training, have them get a discount on the premiums for those people who go through a good server training program. Florida has a bill today that says if you go through server training, you shall get a discount on your insurance premium. So I don't think they're necessarily mandating that the insurance industry give a discount, but they're putting it right in their statute that there should be discounts for those servers who go through server training programs. Finally, the recovery cap issue, which is talked about in some circles, is a question of whether or not you can help define the risks of liquor liability by putting a cap on the amount of damages that one can recover in a state. Presently, Illinois has a recovery cap of $30,000 and $40,000, depending on the circumstance. Connecticut has a $50,000 cap. I believe New Hampshire just passed a $200,000 cap. and North Carolina has a $500,000 cap. These are being pushed by people who think that can help the insurance liability question by help making the boundaries more clear. But that doesn't cut against the basic principles of tort law, which is to give victims the compensation they deserve. And there are a lot of dram shop cases that go well over $500,000, which is the top recovery cap in the nation in North Carolina. So we don't recommend a recovery cap in our Model Act. We think that that really undercuts the basic principles of tort law, which is you are suing to get compensated for your injuries, and a lot of times those injuries will add up to lots and lots of money. It might cost $300,000-$400,000 for a person who is in a coma and brain dead to be maintained on a yearly basis. So the damages can be quite large. And again, the insurance question can be best met by perhaps implementing server training as part of that, or making standardizing server training, or taking over the insurance question as a state. The one recommendation I did read in the task force regarding recovery caps was that if you made the standard a strict liability standard as part of your dram shop statute, then that would offset the harshness of a recovery cap. Well, we feel that a strict liability standard is not the best way to go. Illinois and Connecticut right now have a strict liability standard. Strict liability meaning if you contributed to the intoxication, you are liable as a licensee. We feel that's a little too harsh, and in fact, that will encourage more nuisance suits. If somebody goes bar hopping and goes to seven different bars, you can say that all those bars contributed to the intoxication, and that's really too harsh for all those people to contribute to the recovery itself. Illinois has this very low cap, so all the licensees simply kick in their money, and because the recovery cap is so low, $30,000, it's not that hard to get insurance. But these people are paying money when they shouldn't be paying money. So a strict liability standard is not the best way to go, we feel. Going to a criminal standard to a basic general negligence standard is the best feature I think you can do. It's certainly more equitable for all concerned, especially when you have comparative negligence where you can apportion the fault. So in sum, I think that if any sections of the model law be implemented or at least looked at in any real way, Section 10, the Responsible Business Practices Defense, is I think the best provision that can make dram shop an effective deterrent against preventing alcohol-related injuries. That's all the comments I have.
Madam Chair.
Turn your back.
Now, Madam Chair, if you would pretend that you're a bar owner for a moment, you're serving me drinks, tell me what you'd be looking for and how you would determine if this person is intoxicated, should have two drinks or three drinks or what have you. I would like to reduce things to the practical application.
Sure. What you can do as a server, when a person comes in, you can size them up. And you should know, and any server should know, that they can guess a basic body weight and say, at that body weight, a person can have so many drinks to get to the legal limit of intoxication, 0.10. And then you can work off that. You can say, if a person comes in and you don't feel they've had any drinks, you can say, well, they're about 165 pounds. It would take them approximately five drinks to get to the 0.10 stage. And once you have sort of a general basis for that idea, then you can best help pace the drinking because you burn off one alcoholic drink per hour. So if you have 2 hours of service, you can serve them six drinks and still be under the 0.10 limit. Now, 0.10, I want to get confused. 0.10 and the intoxication standard in a dram shop case is not the same thing, but if you're making them illegal for criminal driving, for drunk driving, you don't want to do that either. But obvious intoxication can result for people who are less than 1.0, but that's a tangential point. So when a person comes in, I think any server, when you do server training, I've been involved in some server training programs, you tell them how to size up a patron. And if you have too many customers and things are coming too fast for you and you have a very busy bar, well, perhaps you need to restructure your bar in a way that you have enough adequate personnel so you can have everybody who can pretty much count drinks. So we're talking about counting drinks in a very general way and pacing the service of alcohol as well. And you don't need to cut off a person. You can say, you want to make this one a cook. Because in your mind, this next drink puts them over. But if you pace them for a while, you can say that I can serve you down the road, perhaps, if you can still be here. But right now, I can't serve you this drink.
That, to me, is the biggest problem. I've seen it in bars where the people are reaching over the top on Saturday night or Friday night. And I'm just trying to figure how that person's going to be trying to ring up the cash register, keep track of these things.
Well, it's certainly tougher for a mom-and-pop type place that just caters to a local neighborhood crowd than a big chain of restaurant bars who do have the money and time to put into server training and to have adequate personnel on staff. So we take that into account and we say, when you talk about what is responsible business practices for an establishment, we take into account the type of establishment being done and all that type of evidence, whether it is a mom-and-pop place and whether they do cater to neighborhood folks and whether they know the people. That needs to be heard by the jury. The jury right now is only hearing, yes, they were drunk, no, they weren't drunk at the time of service. That's too narrow of a plane of evidence to look at. It's very unfair to both sides. So we want to open up the standard of proof being discussed in these cases and say, if the mom and pop place did all they could based on the type of establishment they run, give them a defense. So I think implementing something like Section 10 would help the mom and pop type place as opposed to hurt them.
When somebody comes in, you can count the ones that they have there, but what about the person who's been someplace else?
Right, at that point, you have to be watching for signs of intoxication. So if you think when they come in, they're not exhibiting any signs, but two drinks down the road, they're starting to exhibit signs of intoxication, you need to take that into account. And any good server training program will give you a laundry list of what are signs of intoxication. And the courts say that obvious intoxication is apparent to any common person on the street. Anybody in this room can tell you what intoxication is. And it's just simply the basic common sense signs we all see people who become intoxicated.
But my point was that they come in maybe just having had two drinks or three drinks, and that's not obvious intoxication.
Right, in that case, it would not be fair to hold them liable if you had the ones that put them over. The standard still remains. You must serve a person who is obviously or apparently or visibly intoxicated. Even if you're trying to count drinks and they kind of slip in between the cracks, I think Section 10 will provide that licensee with a defense. The standard still remains. The person must be obviously intoxicated. And your old statute just said intoxicated. And I noticed you were amending it to include what is kind of broaden the definition of intoxication. I think that's very important and a very good thing to do, because people can't be held to a standard of guessing what intoxication is. It must be obvious. It must be apparent.
Virginia. Representative Collins
had
another one
of
this line. I'll get back to you,
Representative Boucher. Thank you, Madam Chair. I can see that it seems to me that server training is a good idea, excuse me, but I'm wondering if it's really practical, you know, given into consideration the fact that people, generally speaking, who work as waiters and waitresses in bars, basically that's a patient population, and that's more so in Alaska, I think, maybe than anywhere else. Secondly, generally speaking, they're not professionals. They're usually doing something on the way to doing something else. People don't choose being a bartender necessarily or being a waitress as a career, but it's basically something they're doing as a sidelight. And secondly, I'm wondering if it's really realistic to expect that those people, despite the fact that they've had server training, are really going to be able to discern between someone who has used another substance, i.e. marijuana and cocaine, and combines that with alcohol. I'm just wondering if that puts an unfair burden on them, or if we're asking them to do something they possibly can't do. Also, someone who has a chronic drinking problem, it's my understanding that a significant number of the people involved in auto accidents that cause death are people who have a chronic drinking problem. Well, someone with a chronic drinking problem can have 10 drinks and not show it, whereas somebody who just hardly ever drinks will have two glasses of wine and they're bombed. And what I'm saying is it's easy to pick out that person who's bombed, but you can't pick out the person whose alcohol level is way up there. His blood level is way up there, but still aren't showing any symptoms because they are a chronic abuser or user of alcohol. So I'm just kind of curious if it's really practical. I mean, it's a good idea, but I'm...
Okay, let me address your last question first. Whether or not service of alcohol to a person who is an alcoholic or has an alcohol problem, and how they don't show symptoms of intoxication. If you can show, as a plaintiff's attorney, that the person was served 10 drinks within a couple hours span, then anybody who knows the slightest about alcohol and the effects will know that 10 drinks in a matter of 2 hours will create a blood alcohol of over 0.10. So courts have said that even those intoxication signs that aren't obvious don't emanate from that particular case. If the evidence says you served them 10 drinks within a short period of time, that will lead to liability. So I think that those servers who just say, well, they're not showing obvious signs, here's another drink, that's negligent right there, because they should know as a basic part of their job skills and job training, whether or not they have actual server training. They should know that each drink of alcohol is about 0.02, and you get about 5 of them with a medium-sized person, that's 0.10. So despite lack of obvious signs, that's negligent to serve somebody a large amount of drinks in a short period of time. But getting back to your other questions, whether server training is practical or not, I've done server training in the San Francisco Bay Area, and it's very surprising to me to note how many people don't know what the legal liabilities are for themselves. They don't know what signs of intoxication are. They don't know the physiology of alcohol. They don't know that alcohol is a poison, a toxic substance, and it has killed people at a rate of over 400 people a year by consuming too much alcohol. You think that people have a common sense awareness of alcohol, yet when you do these training programs, people are starting from ground zero in many cases. And server training sounds like a good idea in the abstract, and that's why it's better to make it part and parcel of licensing, perhaps, where people must go through server training. And the fact that they do go through server training gives them more job pride and gives them a more professional attitude about what they're doing. The trainer I work with often likes to say that servers are the best link in the chain of prevention. We could talk as researchers and scientists about what alcohol is and what it isn't and all the biomedical effects, what have you, and go to conferences and discuss it. But who is the best person best able to prevent a drunk driving accident? Once a person is intoxicated, they don't have those skills and mind process that prevent it themselves. The people who are serving the alcohol are the best links in that chain of prevention to actually prevent DUI or other alcohol-related injuries.
Representative
Boucher. I'd like to continue on this training, my line of thought there. Are there any video films or training courses that have been structured that this body could look at and see what we're talking about training? What is the cost of training? How long does it take? In other words, I'm a bar owner, and my wife and I run. I'm using that as an example. I'm not a bar owner. Now, what are we involved in? And then when we get through that, what feeling of security do we have that it's actually accomplished the goals and objectives? In other words, I want to define training more than just say we pass a law and people go through training.
Okay, well, I brought along with me, if you'd like to look at it, the curriculum for a server training program that I've been involved in. Let me backtrack just a moment and say that server training is so new that the evaluation of training and whether it really works is still premature. In fact, there's a study on that very point, where I'm working, Prevention Research Center. They're implementing a very large-scale server training program on a Navy base in San Diego, the Officers Club. And they just completed the training itself, and it took approximately 18 hours. It's six three-hour sessions. And I'm not saying you need to do 18 hours of training to have effective training. I'll talk about the different types of training in the country that were happening. This was a good training. They just said, we're going to do the best job we can. They just completed it. They obviously took a lot of facts and data based on what was happening in the bar before training was implemented, and now they're going to take as much data as they can on what is happening in the bar after the actual service, the actual number of incidents involving intoxicated people on the premises, on the base itself, the number of DUI, all the data they can possibly get, they're going to get, and there will be obviously a large-scale evaluation done on whether or not good server training has any real effect. But whether or not scientifically it can be shown that it has a real effect, I think just based on my personal experience in doing server training with people, that it's very effective because these people you think know something about alcohol, know about the physiology of alcohol or signs of intoxication, or even their legal liabilities. These people don't know. They face misdemeanor charges in the state of California for serving a minor and obviously intoxicated person. They don't know that it could lead to licensing revocation or fines to the state ABC. They don't know that it could lead to civil liability even. All those are effective deterrents to preventing the improper service of alcohol. But there's generally two types of training that are happening in the country these days. The alcohol beverage Beverage Industries 2 years ago said, server training, what do we want to do with it? Server training is not important, and they took a totally negative view toward it. And then they saw that it was really happening, and states were looking at it in a very real way. So what did they do? They started their own server training program. So the National Restaurant Association has their own program, a program through the Licensed Beverage Association, which stemmed from a Michigan program started. There's the TIPS program, the TAM program, Techniques of Alcohol Management. These programs I term awareness. They're very short. They're about 3-4 hours, a one-shot deal, and they give these licensees just the general awareness of alcohol, the problems of alcohol. But they have an inherent conflict, I think, with doing a good job with server training. One, it's only awareness. They don't get into any real skills building. And second, they're too short, and they're talking too much about how you can still make a buck off serving alcohol. Whereas the training programs that I've been involved in through the Prevention Research Center and some private programs, San Mateo County in California now has server training through the county. These programs are approximately 2-3 hour sessions. They include skills building, not just the awareness on what alcohol is, what it does, the problem in society, but actually teaches them skills of how to cut people off. But that's getting too far down the road. You hopefully don't have to cut people off. If you pace them accordingly and you size them up right and you do all the things, it's not that hard to do, but you simply need to be taught. And there's films, there's role plays. The emphasis is on skills building and to make it more of a professional job for these people. That, we feel, is a better server training program where you actually go through not just an awareness aspect, but actually building training skills in the service of alcohol.
Madam Chair, come right here. Thank you. Is there any state that there is a certified training program? To me, this word training, I'm just a little concerned. I have a feeling that that part of it, just by having the program, and it certainly has got its merits, provided it is a good training program.
Sure.
And that can be training programs. I gather from your conversation that this concept of training programs, just the fact that you need a training program is a deterrent in itself, and undoubtedly it increases the level of awareness of the people who are on the bar and the service of the problems with alcohol. I think you then begin to go down to where you're getting more technical. Is or is this person not drunk? How many drinks have they had? To where one needs to have a bit more specifics. In fact, somebody could say, well, I went to this particular training program and it was reasonably successful. Maybe what if there is a training program brought in, it would appear to be foolish just to say we want a training program without the state actually or the alcohol beverage control people along with industry setting up a meaningful training program. Let's say a small community like Sitka or other people that are removed. And of course Alaska is, except for Anchorage, scattered all over the place, a fifth the size of the United States. So let's say, for example, you're just hiring some bartenders. They're going to be temporary bartenders over the holidays. You might have to fly them to Anchorage to a certified school. I think it's tremendously important if we're going to embark on, quote, training, that we have certified schools, that we just don't send somebody to a course where they invest their time and money. I would imagine just to send somebody up and back from Anchorage, let's say a course cost $500 and it lasted 18 hours, as you say, spread over 2 or 3 days, it would be no small expense. It would be the equivalent to probably sending somebody to college for a half a year.
Well, I fully agree with you. You need a coalition of interests involved in getting a good service training program.
Let me just finish one thing, sure. and then I'll stop this line. You see what my concern is? Not just say we've got a training program and fine, everybody runs through this, quote, training program.
but to get, if we are embarked in that direction, to have one of excellence. Is there a state or is there a training program that you're aware of where there have been noticeable improvements, that there have been results from this particular program?
No, it's happening right now. As I said, the study done at my center has just completed the actual training. I am also involved under contract with San Mateo County to do the legal liability section of training in that county in the Bay Area. And those trainings are happening these days. It just started a couple weeks ago. So it's a very, it's such a state-of-the-art concept that people are still wrestling with the best type of server training. And I agree with you, you don't need to just slap on server training and say that's the panacea for the problem. Why do you think the alcohol beverage industry has their own training right now? The best reason is it's protection from legal liability. They think that now they've seen our model law and they've seen other people who are starting to incorporate server training into their practices. They say, great, let's seize that and say, we've done a four-hour awareness program. See our certificate on the wall? Therefore, that's our defense from liability. And we say right in our model law that no sort of superficial effort of training is going to be enough. It has to be training that is actually implemented at time of service. So you can't just pull up your certificate in court and say, see, we're trained. We can't be sued, or words to that effect. So I think it's important to structure a server training program that is run through the state, that involves the ABC, that involves treatment people, that involves educators, that involves the beverage industry themselves. There's a curriculum that we have developed through the training in San Mateo County that we can certainly pass along to you people as a structured guide to what the curriculum is in server training, because it's very comprehensive and you can always start from over-inclusive list of what to do in training, because you certainly can't do 18-hour trainings with everybody. But you can certainly work from this curriculum and get down to perhaps 2 to 3 hour sessions, which is more reasonable for people to attend, and not make it awareness, but work on skills building it as well.
You know,
Madam Chair, just one. When I had this list, I made a point of calling about 10 or 15 of the owners that have testified, particularly those who testified against them, and most of them are small mom-and-pop operations. And they were just not so much opposed to it, but the question
behind... Excuse me, Jim was unable to hear any testimony.
You're not on.
Excuse me, I don't have my button on. As I said, I called a number of people on the list, people that I know scattered throughout the states, mostly in Bolvar, and I asked them, I said, well, now you testified against it and there's momentum. Why did you testify against it? And I think every single one of them, first there wasn't a single one that did not express a concern, said, well, we wish we had a magic solution where we knew beyond a shadow of a doubt, like we could have a person hold their finger down on this and it would tell us they're drunk and they'd cut them off right there. I think most of them are a little bit concerned about, their biggest question was, what type of program are we talking about? How much is it going to cost? So I think it behooves us to really focus in on the training program, a clearer definition of it, because I think it would be part and parcel to it, possibly with the state and industry offering incentives or things like that. I don't see enough in my folder other than laws. We all know that it's high time the nation collectively and our state in particular. Representative Hurley was pointing out to me on the model law and the responsible business practice defenses. I'm not satisfied that the training program is far enough along.
Well, I think that if we could, I can provide you with the curriculum that we've developed at the Prevention Research Center, and you can use use that as a basis to start with, and we also are working on providing California with its own server training bill, trying to take the best of the bills that are happening in Oregon, in Massachusetts, and in Florida, combine them with the best way to conduct a reasonable yet effective server training program for the state, and how you legislate that. Do you make it part of licensing or tie insurance with it? There's a lot of ways to go with it, and our office is trying to develop the best possible features of all the laws that are being bandied about now, so we can certainly, you know, provide you with that assistance.
Yeah, Ray, this is Mike in general. Would you put me down for a turning badge?
For what?
For a turning badge. I'll come. That's what I'd like to ask, but there's no hurry.
Okay, fine. I'll cue you in a minute. I wanted to ask if you know anything about the techniques of alcohol management that's being taught here in Alaska. That's supposed to be an 8-hour course that the city of municipality of Anchorage made it mandatory in connection with the passage of their ordinance.
I'm not familiar with the program specifically. Is that
it's
on the national program?
It's sponsored by the Cabaret Hotel and Restaurant Retailers. Do you know anything about it, Mr. Mundell?
I believe the speaker referred to the TAM program.
TAM.
It's also known as the one they're using in Anchorage, the TAM program.
Okay.
TAM, is that the one you're talking about?
That yeah, that was the one I was
referring to. Only a 4-hour? They say it's an 8-hour.
Right. Well, not only do you need to talk about how long the programs are, but what actually is in the program. I think you can make a delineation between awareness programs and actual programs that do talk about skills building without the inherent conflict of the beverage industry actually being the sole proprietor of the program. I think the industry must be involved in the dialogue because they're part of the problem and part of the solution. But they cannot, I don't think, on their own accord, put together a inherently fair and equitable service training program without getting input from the state, from ABC, from treatment people, and from educators who've done server training.
Did you have a part in the law that was passed for training in Oregon?
Yes, that was based in part on Appendix B in the model law here, the model server practices bill, and that's something you can also go through to provide guidelines for. And again, putting together the best features of all the bill is something that a lot of states, I don't think just our organization through California, is working on right now. It's happening. This year is the first year that server training is really taking off in state legislatures as a real topic to be discussed. So it's still very early, but I think there's enough information now to put together a good program and then make it very workable. I mean, Dram Shop, we're talking about the most egregious cases in overservice of alcohol. Where, you know, a lot of times the happy hour situation is something that's being legislated against in a lot of states. I think 12 states banned happy hours last year alone. So these are the types of establishments that, you know, can only lead to improper service when you have two-for-ones or ladies drink free and all that. So when everybody talks about Dram Shop, you think that it's going to hit everybody on the street. Most people, I mean, the large majority of licensees are doing all they can and are responsible. But I think there's a lot of awareness that needs to be taught, as well as just basic signs of intoxication and other skills that need to be taught that you can get in these server training programs.
Do you want to ask a question at this point, Representative Clarkson?
At some point, Madam Chair, I'd like to. I have two or three questions of him, and that's sort of separate from my testimony. I also hope to have a chance to testify briefly, but I do have some questions of this witness.
Okay,
given us some great testimony.
Yeah, I want to check with Representative Miller and Juno. Are you ready to? I'll let you ask your questions now, and then we'll go to Representative Clarkson.
Okay, the first is sort of an observation, Ms. Quickman, the witness may want to comment on. It seems to me we're almost focusing too much on training and nuts and bolts. Actually, what I think we ought to be focusing on is the correctness or the non-correctness of removing that word criminal from the bill. If we do remove the word, if we decide it's in the public's interest to no longer require a criminal standard, then, of course, one of the solutions for the beverage industry as well as for the state to provide such things as training. It seems to me that's in a more technical area, and the committee doesn't need to concern itself with curriculum and that sort of thing. It seems to me what we ought to do, focusing on, is whether or not it's in the public interest to remove the word criminal from our current statutes. And I think it's always appropriate for us to might say, third-party, unprotected public who personified perhaps by the young child that's just standing on the street corner and somebody comes out of a bar dead drunk and gets in a car and wipes out that kid. That's the public that I think we have to concentrate on and not even our awareness should exceed our awareness for that public. I think our awareness for the beverage industry or the drinker. But getting back to the model bill, my specific question is this. Section 10, I think, has got a lot of very interesting things that I've never seen this before, and they're really intriguing. And my question, though, is this. In subsection A, it says that the defendant's service is not negligent if the defendant does a whole bunch of things. And of course, it's on the balance of Section 10. What happens when a bar has pretty well, in good faith, done all of the items and perhaps even more that's in there, and yet, for some reason or other, a bartender employee, in spite of everything that the bar owner has done, sells too much booze to an intoxicated customer. That customer goes out and, again, is using the child as an example, wipes out a child that was just standing innocently on a street corner. That kid is just as dead. The monetary costs, if you want to measure that, are just as great. But does the victim's family, or in the case of a victim who is not killed, do they have any opportunity for being compensated if they've sort of passed muster on the Section 10.
Okay, I can respond to that. We originally had Section 10A to read that defendant's service of alcoholic beverages is not negligent or reckless if defendant is adhering to responsible business practices. We then amended that to include that phrase at the time of service because we had people ask that very same question. So we feel that somebody who does good server training and or bad server training, any kind of server training, if they don't actually implement it at time of service, then they should not have that defense to liability. But I think that question raises the point that having a Section 10 in the model law simply opens up the evidence to discuss that very question, what kind of practices were being done, as opposed to the very narrow and ambiguous standard of was the person obviously intoxicated. I think that's too narrow of a standard. And just by having a Section 10, you get to hear the evidence on what exactly was done in that establishment, pro or con, relating to their practices in serving alcohol.
Thank you. That's all I have right now.
I think the committee should know that Peter Frelick of the Department of Law is friends with Juneau and could answer any. He's the person I think who drafted the law, the bill that's before us. Also, I wish the record to show that Vice Chair Representative Navarre is present. And he has some questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually just have an observation that kind of popped up. If a bar now refuses to serve someone who is intoxicated or who has had several drinks over a period of time, couldn't a situation exist where they would then get into changing bars every hour in order to continue the consumption? And in that case, we're putting them on the streets even more, going between from bar to bar. And in most places, there are several bars that are popular or people will drink at, and they'll just shuttle from place to place. In fact, adding to our problem of the drunk driver.
Well, I think that begs the question a bit. You're assuming that one bar won't mind serving somebody who is obviously intoxicated.
How do you know? I mean, if someone comes into your bar and you're not obviously intoxicated, perhaps, as you say, I'm sure you're the much more expertise on this than I have, there are signs of intoxication. However, if someone goes to one bar and has three drinks or four drinks and then they're refused service, they probably aren't exhibiting the outward signs of intoxication. Then they go to another bar and they might even drink while they're on the way, and they go in the other bar and attempt to be as sober as possible, or they're out on the dance floor and someone orders a drink for them.
Well, I think, I discussed earlier, I think before you arrived, that it's important for people not to get to the point where they need to cut off somebody from service. There are ways to handle people who you think, what we call pacing in these training programs, to pace a person's drinking, so you don't need to say, well, that's it, you're cut off for the rest of the evening. You can pace them throughout so that you don't need to get to that point. So you can say, why don't you make this next one something else? I can serve you more alcohol down the road, but right now, this drink can put you over the limit. And if you have that expertise as a server, that can sound real good to somebody, as opposed to, I have to cut you off, I'm sorry, and I really can't give you rationale why, but I'm just told to. When you go through a training and a person becomes aware of these issues and becomes well, they feel like they can actually respond to somebody's question, well, why are you cutting me off, or why are you offering me a cup? Well, that's because right now, I would say you're around 0.10 or near 0.10, and I will put you over the legal limit. If I serve you this, make this next one a Coke. And if they know that you can burn off one drink of alcohol in an hour's time, and they're still around, you can serve them more alcohol down the road. So educating the servers, and it's not that hard to do, can provide them with the ammunition to help pace a person's drink and not get to that situation having to cut them off.
Representative Collins?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Your statement that part of the training would be to teach the servers to pace the customer's drinks, and see, I have a real problem with that because I think it really should be the customer who paces his own drink. I know of a particular bar in town, I don't know how many of them do it, but this particular bar has a designated driver program. And when a group comes in, the waitress offers to buy, that the house will buy drinks for one person who's a designated driver, and as long as they're in the bar, they can have anything they want, provided it's non-alcoholic and it'll be on the house. And I happened to meet some friends there, and I saw this little thing on the table, and I thought, gosh, that's a good idea. And I asked the owner, I called the owner of the bar later, and I said, I think that was a really good idea, and I complimented him on the program. And I said, do people avail themselves of it? And he said, no. So that all comes back to what Representative Miller and Juno asked, you know, have you really accomplished anything if somebody still goes out and kills a child and they're still dead and they still don't have any recourse because the bar is used to defend that they've done everything that they can, and the real problem is the person who's drinking, and I guess that's...
Well, I think if they've done everything they could, then I think they have a much better chance of deterring that person from going out and getting into that automobile or doing what they're doing. And I think a designated driver program is a good idea, but that could backfire too if you're saying that you can have one person who's sober yet serve the other people unlimited amounts, so there's no restraint on the amount you can serve. I think you're creating an atmosphere where all you need is to have your one buddy who agrees to be sober and everybody else can get as drunk as can be. I know that designated driver program stems in part from the kind of European features of drinking there, where people will go into a bar and put their keys into a glass, and that's just, you know, tells the server that, hey, I'm the driver and don't push alcohol on me. So I think a designated driver program is something that's becoming more prevalent, and I think you have your own unique problems in Alaska with the type of drinking that's going on here, but I think it can work, and you don't need to push alcohol on everybody per se. You need to create an atmosphere where drinking is not the sole reason for going to the establishment. It's to have a good time. We say to these people who are servers, what industry are you in? A lot of them think they're in the alcohol beverage industry. That's incorrect. They're part of the hospitality entertainment industry. Drinking is part of it, and we're not neo-prohibitionists here. We're saying alcohol is here to stay, but there's responsible ways to serve it. And if you go through training and you get trained and you become more aware of the issues, I think they can only help in deterring people from actually getting injured, not just a pie-in-the-sky approach, but actually deterring people from getting injured.
Any further questions? Representative Clausen, you have some questions.
Thank you. Actually, Representative Miller asked the first question I was going to ask about the effect of the responsible business practices defense, and did I understand you to say that if somebody implements a responsible business program, yet is negligent at the time of serving the drink, there will be no defense.
That means the defense, right, correct. The defense will not apply, though you're going to have the jury hearing all sides of the issue, and they think they can weigh that on balance and say, well, they slipped through the cracks this time, but these people are doing such a good job. Maybe that would reduce the amount of the award, or perhaps, mitigate the type of punishment. I mean, it's all, what we want to do is open up the aspects of proof being heard in these cases, as opposed to just looking at whether or not the person was obviously intoxicated. So the actual way the defense is applied, I think, will depend on at the time of service. Was it done at time of service? And if all the training involved is not implemented correctly, and a person on good evidence is serving somebody who is obviously intoxicated, then they don't have responsible business practices, correct? And but
I guess my concern would be that what you're saying in your answer is that a person could be negligent and serve someone, and that person gets drunk and goes out and kills somebody on the road, and there will be no liability because the bar made a lot of efforts to try to eliminate the problem, even though there was negligence when that drink was served.
No, if there's negligence, then they should be held liable. But I don't think it's as black and white as you're trying to make to say whether or not they adhere to responsible business practices. If at the time of service it was negligent, then they should be held liable.
Let me take a step back, if I can, with another question. You mentioned at the beginning of your testimony you've done some surveys of state laws, and I assume you've reviewed Alaska's existing law. Would you compare the level of liability in Alaska with other states?
Alaska has a law that I think, in terms of the statute right now, is very simple, and a lot of statutes have come up through different ways across the nation. A lot of these statutes were originally written in the late 1800s, and they keep getting amended, so there's a lot of antiquated language in there, and you still have a lot of language stating that it's illegal to serve habitual drunkards and the like. Alaska, as far as I know, as I stated earlier, is the only state that has a criminal negligence standard, which seems rather anomalous to me when you have a civil liability provision in a law that you make it a criminal standard. Now, criminal negligence is a higher standard than civil negligence, and I think that this model law takes a good approach to that, that criminal negligence might be akin to more reckless service of alcohol. Somebody serving 10 drinks of alcohol in an hour or something like that, that's reckless service, and that's a question maybe you want to reserve for the social host liability provision, if you have one, or having an intoxicated person recover for their own injuries, perhaps at that point you make it a reckless standard as opposed to a negligence standard. I think that criminal negligence standard really makes an anomaly among all the dram shop statutes, and there's 24 of them right now that I've read.